she saw women jumping out of windows, plunging to their death, splatting on the streets. And even though she had already been involved in the fight for better working conditions, this cemented in her mind that, you know, God put her in this place to see this and to do something about it. And God bless her, she spent the rest of her life fulfilling that mission.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, everybody. I'm Stephanie Dre. If you have read my books, America's First Daughter and My Dear Hamilton and The Women of Chateau Lafayette, you know that I love writing about revolutionary women who helped found the nation. But I'm back now with a new story about a founding mother of the 20th century, Frances Perkins, the heroine of my book, Becoming Madam Secretary. So welcome to Sylvia and me.
Stephanie, thank you so much. As I told you when we met just a few minutes ago, I am so excited to have you here with me today because I got my hands on a copy of Madam Secretary a couple of months ago. And within 2.5 days, I couldn't put it down. One of the things, I know you mentioned that you've written other books. Oh, yes, you have. You're also a New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and USA Today bestselling author of, as you said, historical women's fiction. Your award-winning work has been translated into many languages and tops lists for the most anticipated reads of the year. As a matter of fact, BookBub has named Madam Secretary one of the best books of spring. And for our listeners, or I've been told viewership podcast, who are listening, hearing us now, we're taping this just a few days prior to the public release of Madam Secretary. And as you said, I'm just going to read something that I took off of your website.
Okay.
That your focus isn't only on grand narratives. You highlight untold stories, particularly those of women, because you believe that writing and reading historical fiction is essentially an act of empathy, something we need more of in today's world. Yes. Truer words have never been said.
And I'm so delighted that you picked that off of my website, because that is really important to me. I think there's even been studies done that people who read are more empathetic.
Well, as I said, reading this particular book was eye-opening for so many reasons. In particular, Frances Perkins was the first female cabinet, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor back in 1933. But that's not where her career actually started.
So no.
I want to not only go back to how this woman who she was a stylish woman. She was a formidable woman. And is something else, in 1936, she was dubbed most dangerous woman in America.
Personally, I would have put that on my tombstone, but that's, Frances was too modest.
Well, I'd like to go back to, considering we're talking about such a formidable woman, yeah. I want to go back to her start because, yes, she was the first female cabinet secretary. Mm-hmm. She was up against men all over the place, but there had to be a start. What hooked her into even getting remotely into politics?
Mm-hmm. So she did not start out in politics. She was always interested in the fate of the country, though, because her background was that of she was a kinswoman to many famous revolutionary people, such as Mercy Otis Warren, she was particularly proud of, who was a female historian of the American Revolution. And her brother, who wrote the words, no taxation without representation, he coined that slogan. So she and her family were very proud of their heritage. They felt a strong investment in America and their fortune to be here, as well as their responsibility to the nation. And she carried that with her so that when she heard Theodore Roosevelt give a speech talking about how Americans needed to fix the ills that industrialization was causing in this great nation, she felt personally called. She thought that was a spiritual mission. Now, it took some time before Frances got into social work. She, like many young people, was struggling to find her way. She did some volunteer work. She did do some social work, although it wasn't even called social work at the time. They didn't have a name for it right away. And she became a teacher first. She taught chemistry. And then she volunteered at Hull House with Jane Addams. And that's when she really got to roll up her sleeves and get to work in communities that were really suffering in the tenements. And after that, she really embraced it. She gave up her teaching job, which was a high paying job. And she sort of lived on coffee and banana sandwiches to do good. One of her first jobs, and this always tickled me, is that in Philadelphia, she would go undercover to expose pimps and human traffickers. So she was quite brave. And as you point out, she was sort of stylish and daring, which is very much at odds with the public image that she leaves to us.
Well, one of the things, and as you're saying, her public image that we think of is not a stylish woman. And as she went on, she was up against all these men as she was getting further and further into politics, was that she did not want her clothes to be the subject. She wanted what she was fighting for and what she believed in to be the subject. It was enough that she was a woman of quite, and I've said it before, statuesque woman. She wasn't a petite little woman. And she started off with FDR when he was governor in New York. How did that even come about?
So, and I just want to say quickly that she was petite to start with, but like most of us, as we get older, she got a little bit more statuesque. And she did start dressing in a way that was deliberately matronly so that she would be taken seriously. And so that men would stop, you know, pinching her bottom and objectifying her. So she thought if she reminded them of their mothers, that she would be able to be taken seriously. And she was right, sadly.
Yes.
So, when she first met Franklin Delano Roosevelt, she was still working in the social work field. She was not working in politics yet. And he was a lawyer, and she thought quite an unimpressive lawyer. They met at a tea dance, and she did not think much of him. I think she kind of delighted in the nickname that people had for him, which was Feather Duster Roosevelt. so it tickles me, and I know it tickled her because she was sure to put it in her book, that this man who she really just thought was a stuck-up, arrogant, snobby, uncompassionate dilettante, it turns out to be the man to whom her fate is tied the rest of her life. Neither of them knew it at the time. I think that he might have thought of her the same way that her contemporaries sometimes did, that she was maybe a stuffy, insufferable blue stocking. And so I really loved being able to write about this relationship as it evolved over time, because they eventually became friends. When he was struck with polio, she greatly admired his determination to get back up again and get back in the fight. And so they eventually became very good friends and political partners. So she was the natural choice for him to tap when he was governor of New York and he was looking for a woman to have in his in the governor's cabinet. And so he chose Frances, and they went to the White House together.
Well, there was an incident back in New York in the early 1900s, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, which kind of put her onto a mission.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, remind us what the work conditions were back in the 1900s in factories?
So there were very few worker protections at the time. There's no such thing as OSHA. there were many, many fatal and maiming incidents in factories, many fires. The conditions were terrible, dirty, filthy, dangerous. There were little children working in the factories alongside other people. And, you know, I mean, little children whose attention span could not be expected to keep safe conditions. In fact, one of Frances's first encounters with this is she had been volunteering at a mission in her home right after she graduated from college. And a young girl who worked in a candy factory had her hand chopped off. And Frances tried to advocate for her and get her some money to pay the doctor bills and maybe help her secure a future. But it was really ineffectual because this little girl, they didn't even care. They just sent her home with a bleeding stump. And that's the, you know, world that, as it was when the Triangle Shirtwaist fire took place. And for those who don't know, the Shirtwaist fire was infamous because the young seamstresses who were working in this factory had complained many times about the conditions. They tried to strike. They had warned that they were working too hard, too long. The conditions were not safe. And they got nowhere. And on this particularly horrible day, a fire erupted. And when they tried to get out, they couldn't because the boss had feared that they might steal something. So he had locked them in. So they were forced to choose between burning alive or jumping out of windows and dying in the fall, which unfortunately, that's not the first time that's happened in New York City. And hopefully it won't be hopefully it will be, the last time will be the last. But this was an awful, awful thing for people to endure and people to witness. And Frances was a firsthand witness. She had been at a tea party that day, right around the corner. She ran to see this. So she saw women jumping out of windows, plunging to their death, splatting on the streets. And even though she had already been involved in the fight for better working conditions, this cemented in her mind that, you know, God put her in this place to see this and to do something about it. And God bless her, she spent the rest of her life fulfilling that mission.
And it's a mission that she accomplished in so many areas, in basically butting heads with the president, who had, when she accepted the job and moving to DC, she was very adamant about some of the things that she wanted. And, you know, workers' rights and Social Security were on the top of her list. And she really put up a fight. She wasn't backing down. And because of her, we have Social Security. It wasn't there before. And we have public works programs. She, as we talk, she is one of the most influential, consequential women ever.
Yeah. And I mean, and I make the argument, because this is hill that I will die on. I believe she was the most important woman in American history. And I say this even though we currently have a female vice president, we've had a female speaker of the House, we've had other secretaries, cabinet secretaries, but Frances, her work and her accomplishments impacted the next 80 years of American history. There is not one single American alive today whose life has not been impacted by Frances. If you're sitting somewhere and you have a fire sprinkler overhead, you can thank Frances. If you had a weekend, if you got to go to school as a child and not work in a factory, you can thank Frances. If you went to a restaurant during that weekend and there were no rat droppings in your food, you can thank Frances Perkins. And all of this is even before we talk about the massive changes that she made with the New Deal. So I cannot think of any woman who has managed to accomplish so much, impact so much. And frankly, I can't think of another cabinet officer who has been as vital with perhaps other than, you know, Alexander Hamilton. So she's an icon, a legend. I think she should have a street or a park named after her in every city in America. And so I know there are people who will fight me, but I think if people read my novel, they're going to come away and be ready to climb on that hill with me and man the cannons.
Well, you talk about everything that she touched. Yeah. Things that we don't think about.
Yeah.
You know, something as simple as an overhead sprinkler, yeah, or children going to school and not, you know, child labor. We don't think about things like that because we're so used to them. And I'm afraid of saying anything because nowadays, just because they've been in our lives for 50 some odd years doesn't mean they're not going to be taken away. I'm sorry.
Right. And we should take nothing for granted. And she would not want us to.
And that's the thing. I mean, she was a champion. She was a champion for immigrants. She was a champion for workers' rights. She was a champion for women. She was a champion. She was just a champion for treating people as people.
Yes.
And making sure that our futures could be lived.
Yes. And, you know, the accomplishments that I cover in the book are really even still a fraction of the things that she did and a fraction of the things she tried to do. I don't really even get a chance to get into the fact that she cared deeply about the rights of Black Americans. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to accomplish very much in that area. So it wasn't right to sort of champion her in the book as that being an accomplishment of hers. She cared about healthcare. She wanted a healthcare system. She tried and she failed. But imagine how different the world might have been if she had succeeded.
Now, when you write historical fiction, I know you've done a lot of research and you were also able to talk to Perkins' living grandson.
Yes.
How do you mix the history in with the novel in bringing this woman out as a human being, as a character? How do you go about doing that?
Well, I love to interview people who knew or loved her, especially during the time periods that I'm writing, because there were some people who I would have liked to interview, but I knew that the time that they knew Frances was quite past the point where my novel was. So I did talk to her grandson, who is a lovely man, and I'm really hoping that he will love this novel because, you know, I'm always nervous what the family will think because I do have to explore the personal, right? Like in a biography, you would say, for example, Frances's husband suffered from mental illness. And that's kind of all you would say because that's all the evidence that we have. But in a novel, I can't just say he was sick. I have to show how he was sick, how his mental illness progressed, and I have to speculate. And those are very personal kind of moments that, you know, I don't know how family members are going to react to that. They might really dislike it. So I'm always nervous. But I always try to treat my subjects with respect, especially when we're talking about someone like Francis Perkins or even Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, because these people are still informing our political debates today. So it does matter that I not stray too far from the historical record. So those are the kinds of decisions and things that are happening in my head while I'm figuring out how to personalize the story, because it is a novel. First and foremost, you know, we've talked a lot about her accomplishments and all of that, but also it's supposed to be fun and engaging. And I want readers to get really absorbed in the little petty battles that are going on in New York City and in Albany, and the fun sparring that she does with the other politicians, and also the personal stuff, like when Sinclair Lewis decided that he was going to propose to her on a summer night by shouting it in the middle of the streets, and all the crazy antics that they got up. You know, these things are important to include in a novel. And I make sure to include them because I want readers to be sucked in and really enjoy the book. And it's not just an intellectual exercise.
Yeah, what you've done is you weave in the personal so that it gets so interesting that you wind up getting all the education. And for people who really don't want to read historical books, you know, it's like faking them into getting the education, and you can't put it down. Now, one of the things that you mentioned was the fact that Frances was married. She was married. She had a daughter. I believe her name was Susanna. I do remember my children's names. So here you have a woman who has accomplished so much. She has a family. And as you portray, she has some issues in the family. Her husband is sick. He is suffering. And you weave that in. How do you, in your research, how did you decide to put it in the way you did? And then we can talk about the fact that she wasn't just a ballabuster, a bullbuster out there trying to get stuff done. She had a balance being a wife and mother and being a cabinet secretary.
I think, you know, with Paul, Wilson was her husband. And what sort of has come down as legend about Frances and her marriage is that it wasn't very happy, and that, you know, she just married for convenience and she was just a professional girl all the way. And I think this is because Frances did her utmost to protect the privacy of her family. She did not want people to know about her struggles. She didn't want them to know even about much about her personal happiness. And she would say things to her friends like, oh, I just got married to get it over with. And so I think, you know, a lot of people took that at face value. What shocked me is when I was reading through the personal papers is to find genuine love letters and to realize that Frances fell in love with a brilliant economist who was her equal in every way. They had a true romance, which was delightful to portray. They fell in love. They wanted to have children. They had some personal struggles with fertility. Paul was funny and clever and very supportive of Frances. So I wanted to portray the reality that this marriage was actually very resilient and really lovely until later in life it began to disintegrate because he he developed bipolar disorder, which really ate away at his brilliant mind. There was really no treatments for it at the time. And so it was really just left to Francis to try to find some moments of joy in his lucid moments and raise their daughter while having to commit her husband to an institution. And of course, she knew that people would think she was this terribly cold, horrible person who would put their husband in an institution. But Paul was in very bad shape. He was very confused. And so it was a tragedy and something that was poignant and I thought very important to include. So I know Francis would not like that I have done this, but but I think it is a testimony to who she was, and not just in her political life, but in her personal life. She was a woman of great compassion. She was capable of great love and romance. I know people like to think of her as, you know, this no-nonsense lady, but another delightful thing I found about her is that when she was young, she used to write romance stories. So she was a romantic at heart underneath it all. And I love that, you know, novels give you the opportunity to explore all of that.
Well, that's just the thing. You can, and if I use the word embellish, you can take it, and you could take it with keeping the history and making the character someone interesting, but not taking them to an extreme where they're a comic figure or they're a sci-fi. She's a real woman who accomplished real things and raised a real family, had a real marriage. So you do your research, you look at the total person, and you make us fall in love with that person. How did you even pick Francis? How? Why?
So a little bit of background before I sort of get in. The short answer is that I had been researching the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire with my very good friend and sometimes co-author Laura Kmoy. And we sort of stumbled over Francis then. But what struck me is that I did know who Frances Perkins was, but I didn't know much about her. And I only had this image of her in my mind as this sort of dowdy older lady. She was, you know, this very serious cabinet secretary and always wearing black, and, you know, her ankles are swollen. She's an older woman. It hadn't occurred to me that she might have once been a young fashionable spitfire until I encountered her during this research. And, you know, of course, you always, you know, we're so arrogant in our youth, right? We don't think that everyone was young once. And that there sort of tickled me. But what caught my attention most about this is that I hadn't realized how much she was responsible for really my own family's survival. My family are all relatively new immigrants to the American scene. My grandparents, one of them was born in Italy. The others were first generation Americans. They all struggled and they lived through the Great Depression. And I had the very great fortune to have them all alive. I got to chat with them many times about the stories from the Great Depression. And some of them were, you know, sort of funny tales about them foraging for mushrooms or catching squirrels to survive or frogs. But there was a tragic story too. And that is that my great uncle, who I believe was about 16 at the time, he tried to steal some coal from a passing train so that he could keep the family warm during a very harsh Rochesterian winter in upstate New York. And he died in that attempt. And it just devastated the family. It certainly devastated my grandfather, who always idolized his older brother and who ended up naming my father after that brother. And so Roosevelt and the New Deal is something that my family was convinced was their salvation. My grandfather, when he came of age, he joined the Civilian Conservation Corps and was able to send back some money to keep the family alive. And I was always told that if it weren't for Roosevelt, the family would not have survived. And he was, you know, lionized. He was their commander in chief when both my grandfathers enlisted after Pearl Harbor. And also because he suffered from polio and my father suffered from polio. He was one of the last children to get it before the vaccine. My grandmother would say, you know, well, if Franklin Roosevelt can be president, then you have no excuse. You can do anything, Joey. And my dad, you know, went on to do great things and he's lived a wonderful life. So I always heard about Roosevelt, but I never really heard about Frances. And it chapped my hide. I thought there was a woman behind the New Deal and I owe so much to her. And yes, Roosevelt came up with the idea for the Civilian Conservation Corps, but it was Frances who had to execute it. So I'm grateful to her. And once I realized how much I owed her, there was no way I could avoid, you know, I had to write her story.
Well, I'm very glad you did. There are so many women who have done so much and are in the shadows. Totally in the shadows. And I love that one of your main things is getting some of these women out of the shadows showing us, telling us their stories and what they've done and how they've affected our lives, whether it's huge things that Frances did or whether it's a small thing that we don't think about. But we need to bring these women out. They should not be hidden anymore. And the fact that you brought Frances out to do this in a way that makes you want to learn more. And for me, not wanting to put the book down. I think it's fantastic. And I can't wait. I know this is just coming out. And it's coming out in March, which is Women's History Month. So kudos to you. But what I can't wait, you got another book yet?
Yes, I am working on a new book. Laura Kamoy and I are getting the band back together again. And we are writing a book about Abigail Adams and her daughter, Abby. It's going to be called A Founding Mother. And we're very excited about it.
Stephanie, thank you so much. And thank you for what you're doing in bringing women to the forefront. Women who we have been invisible to so many people. And we have to keep bringing these women forward so that younger women can see what can be done.
That's exactly it. It isn't just for posterity. It's so that we know we have to carry the torch for them, pick it up and go forward.
And we don't have to wear pantsuits anymore. If we want to, we can. I mean, it suits a lot of people. It doesn't suit everyone. We don't have to dress in a men's suit. And we can just be out there. That's right. Where can people find out more about you?
Please visit me at stephaniedray.com. I have a special historical book of the month club newsletter that I send out every month. And it's a great way to keep in touch with me and what I'm working on and also to win free books.
Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me today and for becoming Madam Secretary. I thank you for what you're doing in bringing out Frances and other women as we go along.
It was wonderful to talk to you.
Don't go away. Great. Abigail Adams. There's some podcast, the History Chicks. I think they did like a two or three parter on Abigail Adams. That's the only reason why I really know her name. So I can't wait to read your book. But what you've done, this is great. I really appreciate it. You're taking, you know, I've started reading a lot about women authors who are writing about women. One of the other women that I interviewed is Kristen Hanna. Now,
oh my God, love her. Yeah, I'm a huge fan girl.
Have you read The Women?
No.
And well, there's another book that I read in 2 days.
I have it. And I'm just finishing up The Frozen River by Ariel Lawn. So then comes Kristen Hanna's book. And I love The Four Winds. I just loved.
Oh, I've been reading. Now I have to read your other books. I'm sorry, but I'm supposed to be reading books for people that I'm right. interviewing. And I can't put there's a Canadian author that I just put her episode out about a couple of weeks ago, Leslie Crew. And her books are just they're women-centric as far as the story, and they're based in rural whatever. So I started reading it. You know, she's got 15 books. She just debuted in the States, and I've read and at least six of them. And then I was reading Kristen Hanna's book, and you got to read The Women because you won't be able to put it down. And now I have to read all. I guess you know my TV will go away, but what you've done. Here. Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.